Welcome to ICOSA's Driving Force Radio, where we discover what drives today's leaders. Now, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Good morning, and welcome to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover what drives today's leaders. On the show today is Brandon Schaefer, a third-generation Coloradoan and former naval officer. He currently serves as the president of the Colorado Senate. And on today's show, we are going to be talking about all kinds of things, local concerns all the way to the macro issues. And in this very heated political season, the beauty of Brandon's approach is that it's not partisan. It's about the policy that gets made. It's about doing the right thing for citizens here in Colorado and across this country. Brandon, thank you for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
I think so many people hear about politicians and really think about politics, but are a little shy of going in. Can you share with us how you decided and why you decided to go into politics and how you got your start?
Sure. You know, after I served in the Navy, I came back to Colorado to attend law school at the University of Colorado. And while I was in law school, I started getting involved. I wasn't real happy with the state of politics of the state house at the time, where it seemed that they'd taken a very hard right turn in the social politics that were going on. It was all about wedge issues in the politics of the state house at the time. And that's kind of what got me involved. I started volunteering in the community and, you know, eventually attended my caucus and started, you know, getting involved in the politics as well. And in 2004, I ran for office. But, you know, it's interesting because when I talk to young people, especially, they always want to know, well, how do you get into politics?
Right.
Do you need money? Is it something that
right.
you have to be rich in order to run? I'll tell you, as a student in law school, I didn't have, you know, very much money at all, but the grassroots really works. You can still connect with people in your precinct, in your caucuses, and then you can go to the county assembly and meet people there. And I think it was one, maybe two election cycles that I kind of watched and helped out and kind of learned how the process worked, and then eventually ended up with my name on the ballot in 2004.
That's so awesome. And you were elected to the General Assembly here in Colorado in 2004, and in 2009 you became the president of the Senate, yes?
That's right. The way it works is the Senate itself, so the 35 senators vote for one person to be the presiding officer, the president of mm-hmm. the Senate. And I was fortunate to have a unanimous vote. Democrats, Republicans both voted for me to be the president of the Senate. I've served in that capacity since 2009.
Brandon, I know there are so many issues, both local and national, and I think they almost overlap each other to a certain extent. And I want to start with education because it's such a huge issue, and it's one of those underlying factors, it seems, that drives so many other things, economies and job creation and all of that. But, you know, you come from an education family. Your mother was a teacher. Your wife is a fifth grade teacher, yes?
That's right.
And so how are we going to look at college affordability and K-12 education? How are we going to make these leaps to become competitive again?
Sure. You know, let's start at you know, some of the things that we've done here in the state and at the college level. Affordable access to college is a problem that most families are dealing with right now. You know, as you have a child who's entering middle school or high school, you start wondering, okay, how am I going to pay for my kid to go to college?
Yeah.
It's really expensive these days. One of the bills that I introduced, sponsored in the state house, allows you to transfer 2 years worth of credit from a community college into one of Colorado's four-year universities or colleges. So you can start your four-year degree in a community college now, and then mm-hmm. transfer those first 2 years into a four-year diploma, you know, offered by CU or CSU, something like that.
Sure.
And it really creates more opportunities because the community college is significantly less expensive.
Right.
And when you talk about, you know, some of the rural parts of our state, when you talk about, you know, the community colleges all up and down the 4th Congressional District that I'm running for, you also see it as a way to keep young people in their home communities. So mm-hmm. one of the problems that we're having are young people are moving out of the rural parts of the state into the more urban parts, if we can keep them in college, at their community college, say in Trinidad or in Lamar or La Junta, right, or
Greeley.
You know, Greeley or where, if you can keep them in those first couple years in their hometown, maybe they'll stay there longer and start their businesses and their lives out in the rural parts of the state.
Well, and when we talk about financial aid, I know I am a 43-year-old woman who continues to pay for her higher education. I have 2 years left to go. And there has been so much talk about funding and student loans and things like that. What are you thinking here? What do you see going on here? And how can people really look at that? Because I think we need to consider that. My girls are 5 and 9, and I'm worried already about how we're going to pay for higher ed.
Well, I mean, I think that this is a place where the federal government actually can play a significant role. You know, the Pell Grant system is how a lot of students pay for their college. You know, we were visiting the Morgan Community College in Fort Morgan recently, and I sat down with the president of the college, and he said 80% of the students at Morgan Community College are on financial aid. And I said, well, what kind of financial aid is that? Well, it's all Pell Grants coming from the federal government. And I get concerned because you look at some of the budget negotiations that are going on. You look at the Ryan budget. My opponent in this congressional race, Representative Gardner, voted twice to support this Ryan plan. It would cut Pell Grants upwards of $1,000 per student. And you look not only at what that does to affordability of college, but you look at what it does to that institution that, you know, needs that tuition to help sustain the Morgan Community College. You know, it has, you know, both primary and then secondary impacts on the economy and affordability of college.
Absolutely. And so when we back up a little bit and we talk about K-12 and early education, what are some of the things that you're suggesting in terms of early childhood ed and K-12?
Sure. I've always been a strong proponent of high-quality preschool and full-day kindergarten. And it's something that I've been passionate about here in the state of Colorado. I think that one of the things the states can do to give kids more opportunity and more chances at success later in life is make sure that they get the very best start in their education as possible. And the research bears it out. Now, it's a long-term investment.
Sure.
Now, you're not going to see the ramifications overnight. I mean, it's something that you're investing in the people of our state and our nation by making that investment in early childhood education. We see that we have fewer kids who are addicted to drugs. We have fewer kids who are getting in trouble with the police. And we have more kids who are graduating from high school and moving into a college post-secondary education degree track if they've had access to early childhood education. It's a place where we get a huge return on our investment, both as a state and a nation, when we make that that investment up front.
And so it's really about this early initial investment that has a long-term impact that's you know, tough to even put numbers to, because you know that you're going to see it play out at the end of the day.
That's right. But the data is there. I know that the University of Colorado has done a long-term study to see, you know, test case, you know, with kids who go to a full-day kindergarten program versus kids who don't. They can see that that it really makes a positive impact on these kids' lives. And, you know, it's cost-effective. It's a, it's a great return on our investment when we make that investment up front.
Well, I want to switch gears for a second. You know, we've talked a little bit about rural Colorado and rural communities. I think this applies across most of the United States. But you have a farm bill out there. Talk about that legislation and why it's important to folks around here.
I mean, this is the primary piece of legislation that Congress works on, supposed to work on every 5 years is kind of what they authorize it for, to help farmers and ranchers across the entire country. I mean, it's something that they've been doing since the early 1920s. So this is a very significant piece of legislation, and it's not something that's new. I mean, it's something that has been reauthorized now for decades. What's disappointing is that in the toxic political environment that you described at our opening, you know, this Congress can't even pass a farm bill, which is ridiculous, especially when you're looking at something like, you know, the 4th Congressional District, one of the largest rural districts, agricultural producing districts in the entire state.
So what is the impact that this impasse is having on farmers and the bill itself?
Well, you look at it from the perspective of a farmer. I mean, if you are planning for next year's crops, you are trying to figure out what the economic conditions are going to be. I mean, it's bad enough that you can't predict the weather, right?
Right.
Now you can't predict Congress. And here's a perfect example of where Congress has become an obstacle, which is actually depressing our economy, which is actually hurting people in our country, as opposed to trying to help them. You know, when we talk about Colorado Solutions, when we talk about, my brand of politics that I want to take to Washington, D.C., it's about making government an effective partner with the private sector to help us get the private sector in a place where they can succeed, whether that's an investment in our education system or whether that's passing a farm bill that creates stability and predictability in markets. I think those are important things.
So when you talk about this partnering with private sector, and you've mentioned it, that we're at this impasse in Congress, how do you think Congress gets past this? I think we see so much bickering
right.
on the sides.
Right.
How do we get past this, and how do we really have thoughtful discussions about things that impact the most base things of our economy? And,
right.
I don't mean that negatively, but farmers put food on our tables, and they drive
right.
economies, and they are sort of that one of those foundational industries here in the United States.
Yeah.
How do we get past this?
It's leadership. I mean, it's leadership. And the problem that I see today in the United States Congress is Congress is no longer working for the people of the United States. Right? The United States, people of the United States are working for their Congress people. It's all about, this self-preservation, where they're running to make sure that they can be reelected in the next election cycle. Well, that's not right. They need to focus on addressing the real issues that matter to people back home. And that's what they've lost sight of. They're not, rolling up their sleeves and being practical and pragmatic. They're not sitting around and with good faith intentions of compromising it to reach a deal that they can move forward and get the votes on the floor of the House of Representatives and the United States Senate to get to the president to sign. They're just playing politics. And that is what is so frustrating.
Yeah.
I go door to door in this district and I see, I talk to people on a regular basis at their doorstep who are just so frustrated. They don't always know exactly what's wrong, but they know something's wrong. And at the end of the day, I mean, we're all reasonable, rational people. Well, most of us are, right?
Right.
And we ought to be able to come up with a proposal that we can move forward that'll give us a balanced, responsible, balanced budget, allow us to pass something as basic as the Farm Bill, allow us to make investments in infrastructure and in our country, prevent us from outsourcing jobs to other countries. I mean, these are all basic things,
mm-hmm.
and we need leadership in Congress to get it done. And unfortunately, I don't see that leadership coming forward, certainly not out of the 4th Congressional District.
Right, right. Well, and we're going to come back and talk about that in segment two a little more in depth as well. But I want to talk about energy because it's such a big conversation going on here in Colorado, nationally, but also in your district up in the 4th Congressional District. And, I want to talk about the government's support of fossil fuel extraction mm-hmm. versus the subsidies they're offering to renewables. Can you talk about that a little bit and give us your opinions on that topic?
Sure. I support an all of the above strategy. I was at an event recently where somebody said, well, everybody supports all of the above strategy now. And it's true. I mean, I think that is something that Democrats and Republicans can agree upon, is we need to have a diverse portfolio of energy options so that we are less dependent or entirely independent of foreign oil supplies. I think that is the right direction to go. But that portfolio has to be balanced, and we need to have the investment both in the renewables and the traditional forms of energy. And I think that there are those in Washington, D.C. who want to weight that portfolio towards the coal and the oil. And I think that we need to, authorize the renewable, the wind energy tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make sure that we're investing in innovation, that we continue to remain on the cutting edge. We continue to look for new technologies to help us wean ourselves off of foreign oil and to make ourselves more independent.
Sure. Well, Energy is always a huge conversation here on the Driving Force show. We do a show at least once a month just on energy because it is such a huge conversation. And we always talk about that there is no way to just have a clean energy portfolio at this time. I mean, we have been so traditionally based in coal and our traditional oil sources and petroleum sources, but we do need to be supporting these innovative things. So how does this stuff get funded from that, from this top-down approach around these clean energy strategies? Because I think there's this argument around things like the wind energy tax credits, and we've seen solar, and I know there's a lot of black marks, if you will, Solyndra and some of those folks. So how do you make that argument? What do you say to that?
So the tax credits and the subsidies that go to the oil and gas industry as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of it comes together. And one thing that I have implemented in the state legislature, whenever I see an important piece of legislation that's coming through, I always want to, you know, put in place what I call a post-enactment review process, a look-back window, if you will. So 3 to 5 years down the road, we commission an independent audit of the tax credit or the subsidy that's being, you know, given to see if it's actually working. We ask the question, and we don't make the assumption that it's indefinite, that we'll always do this. We ask the question, you know, whether or not we're meeting the goals that we set for this tax credit when we first put the tax credit in place. Is it stimulating research and development? Is it creating jobs? Is it, you know, creating economic development? Is it producing a source of energy in this case that's sustainable, that's viable for the future? And go through the analysis. If it's working, okay, maybe we want to extend it for another 3 to 5 years. Sure. If it's not working, let's get rid of it. And what you're seeing in this energy portfolio are subsidies that have remained in place indefinitely, almost as if it's a right that, you know, some of these, you know, huge corporations have the right to have the subsidy indefinitely. It's what they've earned or something of that sort. But that's not right. I think that what frustrates people is when they see their tax dollars being spent without any, you know, sideboards or controls or any accountability tied to the money that's being laid out there. So I would say that in all of these things, we make the investment with the best of intentions up front, and then we have the look back window where we analyze whether that investment is really paying off 3 to 5 years down the road.
I love that there's some sort of analysis on the backside, because I think so often, and this is across all different policy areas, that kind of gets lost sometimes. And I think we've seen that as all these budget discussions have happened in Washington over the last couple of years around this look back. And people are really in the Beltway are pushing back about this. Oh, we have to prove something, or we have to say how much this really cost. Right. And I think that's such a shocking thing, because here in the business world and in your everyday businesses that are out here in America, we all look at back at That's things right. and make sure that they're working or not.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the economy and jobs, this has been a contention point between the Democrats and the Republicans on the ends. And I think this has been a solid discussion in the middle, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I say the thinking Democrats and the thinking Republicans, and then you have the non-thinkers on the end. But does government really have the ability to create jobs?
Well, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, right? We talked about government being an effective partner with the private sector. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, when you look at, you know, the way our government or our private sector is set up, it really is a partnership. You look at our infrastructure, for example. You know, there are businesses out there that, you know, need a safe roadway to transport their goods from point A to point B. You look at our high-tech industries, you know, aerospace becoming a burgeoning industry here in Colorado, in the 4th Congressional District.
Sure.
You need to make sure that you have an education system that is ready to, you know, to educate our young people so they can take the new jobs that are being created in our state. And a lot of that infrastructure, a lot of the education, you know, we could talk about different sectors as well, you know, requires that investment from the government, whether it's federal or state, in order to support those those networks in order to support that foundation that can allow government to be that effective partner with private industry, private sector. So, you know, I think that, you know, it is a partnership that we need to continue to nurture, continue to foster. And the other side, you know, one of the things that I think is a challenge is when the government becomes, it goes overreaching, you know, puts too many regulations in place. You know, so there's this balance that has to be struck between the two. And when we get the balance right, you know, government can be very helpful in helping the private sector create jobs.
So I think I heard this correctly. I think that you're saying it's more of a partnership, but you're not there to create jobs, but you're there to help the support of creating jobs by industry, correct?
And I think that's an accurate way to put it. You know, and in the process, you have police and firefighters and teachers and road construction workers, and they're all getting a paycheck from either the state of Colorado or the federal government. So, you know, it's not as clean as and simple as the question lays it out.
Right.
But ultimately, the investment is making government an effective partner with the private sector, so the private sector can do what it's really good at, and that is expand and employ people, put people back to work.
So, Brandon, you know, as you move from a state level to potentially a federal position, how do you see Congress taking on the role of helping create jobs? What can they do? What's one action that Congress could do to help in this area?
Sure. You know, there's a proposal out there. I think it's really an innovative thing. It is a tax credit that goes to small businesses that partner with universities to give job training to students as they're preparing to leave the university level into the workforce. And the tax credit, you know, rewards the small business if they actually hire one of those students. I mean, here's a partnership, again, where, you know, the governmental entity is becoming an effective partner with a private industry to provide a workforce that will support their industry and their businesses.
Well, and I know in the Colorado Solutions work that you have laid out that there's a lot of very specific stuff about helping small businesses. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you hope to bring with the Colorado Solutions work that you've created?
Sure. I mean, the Colorado Solutions is more of a concept. Mm-hmm. It's where we kind of put our differences aside and we focus on getting the job done. I know you're from Pueblo, and I'm from, you know, the metro area here, and you know, we're both third generation Coloradans, so this hopefully resonates with you. I sat down with my grandmother early on when I was first running for office, and I asked her, if there's one piece of advice that you give to a young guy who wants to be a public servant in Colorado, what would it be? And her response was, never forget that this is the West. Never forget that, you know, this is where we do things differently, where we need to, when we need to get something done, we kind of put our different, we just focus on solving the problem and getting things done. That's the attitude that I've taken to the State House. That's the attitude I'll take to the United States Congress. And certainly, I think we need a healthy dose of Colorado Solutions in Washington, D.C. And frankly, if we can get to that point where people see that we have a governing body in Washington, D.C. that actually is responsive to the needs of our country, the people in the middle class here who are looking for those jobs, I think that in and of itself is going to help us create jobs and put people back to work.
Absolutely, and I love that your grandmother says that, because I think I might actually really like your grandma. I too, as a middle class person who lives in suburbia and has lived in Colorado my whole life, I look at so many things that are on the news and through the news feeds and just what's out there right now, and it just seems so unauthentic. It just seems so hateful right now. Right. And I think there are so many things that we could be doing if we could check our egos to a certain extent at the door and really have a real conversation and get the work done, like your grandma says and like you say. Let's just do the work. And we'll figure it out. And I love that. So on the training and the supporting of America's workforce in this, for these 21st century jobs, what are you seeing there, Brandon?
You know, I think there's it runs the entire gamut. You know, one of the things that you're seeing here is a really synergistic partnership with some of the high-tech industries in our state. You're looking at some of the aerospace that's coming in. We just passed legislation this last session to allow for a spaceport to be built in outside of the Brighton area, you know, to launch things into outer space. How cool is
that? That's great.
The biotech industries in the state are burgeoning. I mean, there is really kind of a, you know, whether it's University of Colorado, CSU, the Anschutz campus, they're doing amazing things with biotech. You look at clean tech and the renewables, you know, whether it's the wind, the air, the solar. I mean, there are so many really innovative, cool things that are going on in our economy right here in Colorado and in the 4th Congressional District. That there's a huge opportunity when we look at making investments in things like our school systems, whether it's early childhood or whether it's higher education, when we talk about our transportation infrastructure, you know, to get a rocket to the spaceport, you know, it's not easy. You've got to have roads to do that.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of things that we can do, again, to be an effective partner as government with that private sector to create those jobs and help people get back to work.
Well, Brandon, we have to go to break. And when we come back, we'll have more with Brandon Schaefer. And we'll be talking more about the macro issues going on here in Colorado as well as in D.C. And to learn more about Colorado Solutions, go to schaeferforcolorado.com. That's S-H-A-F-F-E-R for Colorado.com. Don't go anywhere.
Now, let's return to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA, with your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Welcome back to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover what drives today's leaders. We're back with Brandon Schaefer, who's running for Congress and has been really an integral part of Colorado's General Assembly since 2004. In 2009, he was the elected president of the Senate here in Colorado, and he's been an integral part in bringing a positive conversation, a dual-sided conversation to Colorado politics. And going to Washington, I think that might be one of those fantastic things that you'll be able to bring, hopefully, to conversation there is maybe some civility and being able to work across the aisle.
Well,
yes,
I hope
Brandon?
So. That would certainly be one of my goals, that's for sure.
Here in Colorado, we used to have a very contentious political scene, and you've managed to create a political scene that's a little more collaborative. How did you do that?
You know, it's really not that difficult. When you get enough lawmakers in the room and you kind of shut everybody else out and you just say, hey, look, guys, you're not coming out of there until you come to some type of agreement. That is how you do it, because, you know, across that table with people who are actually working on the floor of the Senate, floor of the House of Representatives, you know, they can, you know, make relationships, get to know each other personally, know that each side is coming to the table with good intentions, trying to accomplish basically the same things. Our end goal is basically the same. We want to create, you know, safe communities. We want to create good schools. We want to create opportunities for middle-class Americans and Coloradans to succeed. I mean, that's what we're all down there to do. So if we can just kind of get in the same room and start communicating and trying to figure out where we have common ground so we can move forward, it's amazing what you can accomplish when you do that.
It seems like the civility has broken down in that it's almost the win if you can bring the negativity, and that it's a weakness if you work together. So when did it become a weakness to really work together politically across the aisle?
You know, sometimes I say, you know, advertising execs are in control of Washington, D.C. You know, they're telling everyone what to say and how to say it and when to say it and, you know, what to do. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I had a great experience. I went up to UNC. And I spoke to an American government class of, I think there were sophomores, maybe juniors in college. There were about 35 students in the class. And, you know, before the class started, we went around the class. Everybody introduced themselves. I asked them, what high school did you graduate from? It was fascinating to me because they had all graduated from Colorado high schools. And it was all over the state. So we had a great representative sample of students from all parts of the state of Colorado. And through the course of our conversation that evening, we put up on the whiteboard a series of wedge issues, you know, divisive issues that, you know, politicians, whether it's in the State House or whether it's in Washington, D.C., have a very difficult time, you know, seeking common ground on. And we went through each one of them. We discussed them. And it was unbelievable. 8 out of 10 of them, we had consensus in the room with all the students, you know, where they would be, what they think the policy should be around these wedge issues. Now, if you're an advertising exec, though, right, and your job is to sell one party over the other, you're not going to focus on that 80% that everyone agrees on.
Right.
You're going to focus on that 2% that's divisive. And it's exactly what's going on. You know, it's selling Coke versus Pepsi. You're not going to focus on the 90-some-odd percent of the ingredients that are identical, right? You're going to focus on what's different. And then you're going to try to convince people that one's better than the other. Well, that's what's happening in our society. That's what's happening in Washington, D.C. Whenever they try to package their new jobs package or their balanced budget package, it is, well, we're better than the other guy. It's never, hey, let's all work together and come up with what's in the best interest of the people of the United States of America. That's not how they present it. There's
the
Republican plan.
Sell.
Here's the Democratic plan. And that's a frustration I have with the political environment today. We have to break through that. You know, my mom's a Republican. I happen to be a Democrat. I love my mom. And, you know, it doesn't matter to me what her party affiliation is. And we've got to get a, you know, past that and start focusing on solving problems to move our country forward.
So, Brandon, give us an example of a time where you overstepped to the other side and you introduced legislation regardless of the position of the party.
Sure. You know, I did pension reform legislation here in the state. You know, sometimes you see Christie in New Jersey, you know, stepping up and talking about the reforms that he made to the pension system in that state. You know, the conversation that, you know, very few people have had here in the state, people realize here in the state, we've done very similar things in the state of Colorado to stabilize our pension system for state employees. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about the state patrol. We're talking about prison guards. All the state you know, workers get what's called PARA, the Public Employee Retirement Association. My mom, by the way, is on PARA. So while we were going through it, you know, she was very interested in all the things that we did. And they were difficult choices. I mean, in 2008, the trust fund that underwrote the retirement fund, you lost $8 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, huge. You know, for our state government, you know, we can't just make that up in 1 year. So I reached out to Josh Penry, a minority leader in the state Senate at the time, and said, hey, you know, Josh, we've got to figure this out. And he and I sat down, and we came up with a proposal. He had his, you know, more conservative perspective on things. I had, you know, some of my perspectives on things, and we put the whole package together. And then we went out and said, here it is. You know, here's what we're proposing to do. And there are a lot of people on both sides, you know, Democrats and Republicans, who came forward and said, this is, you know, either doesn't go far enough, or, you know, this goes too far. And, you know, we stuck, though. You know, Josh and I, we worked together to move that thing all the way through the Senate, got some momentum on it, you know, out of the Senate into the House, moved all the way through the House, and ultimately made it to the governor's desk. You know, when it got to the governor's desk, you know, usually when you sign a major piece of legislation, you have a signing ceremony, you have a little bit of a celebration, a party. We didn't do that in this case because it did involve real sacrifice and real pain, real cuts that were being made to pensions and that sort of thing. But it was one of the most significant things that we've done in the last 5 years, and it has stabilized that pension system for generations to come. And it was an example where, you know, I had members of the Democratic Party coming to me and say, what are you doing? This is crazy. But we did the right thing.
Well, and I think it's inspiring to see that it can work.
Yeah.
And that at a state level, sometimes at a federal level, that there are success stories around working together, and that it doesn't come across as a weakness to be able to work with both sides coming together on legislation that really affects the constituents of the districts around Colorado.
Right.
I want to switch to something because at the end of the day, this is going to be one of these giant issues that we're all going to be facing, and it's about the budget.
Right.
You talked about here in Colorado anyways, we require that we have a balanced budget. But nationally, the issue is really untouchable, it seems like, at this point. So what are we facing right now at a national level around budgets?
Right. You know, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I think the projection is 2025. If we stay on the trajectory that we're on today, you know, by 2025, every time we bounce or we pass a budget on the federal level, we'll just be paying interest off of our debt, which is crazy. We've got to do something to get our arms around the budget and balancing the budget. You know, each of the 8 years I've been in the Colorado legislature, I've been part of crafting and voting for, you know, helping to pass a balanced budget in the state of Colorado. You know, the first 2 years I was in the legislature, we had the Republican Governor Owens. I worked with him to help get it done. Governor Ritter, Governor Hickenlooper. We've all worked together to do our jobs, basically, and pass a balanced budget. You know, I hate to say it, but my opponent in the congressional race, Representative Gardner, in the 6 years that we overlapped in the state house, never once voted for a balanced budget. You know, he always found something that was wrong with the budget. You know, when he got to Washington, D.C., he finally found the Ryan plan, which is something that he's voted for twice. I think that in order to get our arms around the deficit and the debt that we have, you know, the first step is to pay down the national deficit, to eliminate the national deficit. This is the shortfall that we have on an annual basis. And when we don't pay that deficit, it rolls over into the national debt and help, you know, continues to grow the national debt. So the first part is to make sure that our revenues match our outputs, you know, sure, our inputs that match our outputs. And we've got to get our arms around the deficit. Now, one thing that I've done here in the state of Colorado, we passed what's called the Smart Government Act, which you know, puts every department of state government on a schedule for a review by the state auditor to go in and see how they're spending the money, see where it's going, see where there may be waste, see where, you know, programs are either working or not working. And I think that's what the people of Colorado deserve. You know, it comes from something I was taught when I was in the Navy, that you get what you inspect, not what you expect. You know, so let's go in there and let's check these guys out and make sure they're doing what we expect them to do. We need something very similar on the federal level so we know how the federal dollars are being spent.
Sure.
That is the first step towards fiscal responsibility and eliminating the national deficit. And then, you know, beyond that, we have to look at a long-range plan, a long-range, you know, if you will, payment plan for eliminating the national debt. Right now, I get frustrated because it sounds like, it feels like both sides, Democrats and Republicans, are looking for a silver bullet. They want to come to the table and say, okay, this year, here's how we're going to eliminate the national debt. When you look at a $16 trillion debt, it's not going to go away overnight.
No.
And you have to acknowledge that, and then you have to come up with a responsible approach to paying that off over time. I think, you know, if we do the things that we need to stimulate our economy and create jobs, put people back to work, and we tighten our belts at the federal level with our spending, you know, from both approaches, we'll see increased revenues because we'll have a broader tax base because more people will be working. And then we'll also see decreased spending, and that is how ultimately we'll be able to balance the budget.
Okay. So we've heard a lot about it throughout the election cycles, and as we've just come off the conventions for both parties. You know, we've heard everything about Simpson-Bowles and about the Ryan plan, and I think over this last year there's been 8 or so plans that have been proposed. Every single one of them since 2010 have been voted down. How do we get a plan for a balanced budget, as you're talking about, and a budget that really looks at the deficit and really looks at addressing the debt?
Right.
What do we need to be doing?
Well, you know, the Simpson-Bowles proposal, you know, while there's a lot in the proposal itself not to like, the approach was a good approach, where you got, what was it, 18 members of Congress, Senate and House, Democrats and Republicans, in the same room and said, okay, you guys figure this out. And I think the final vote on the proposal that came out, it was 11 in favor and 7 against. They had a super, you know, a two-thirds requirement for anything to actually be approved. So they needed 14 out of 18 votes in order to pass it, mm-hmm. and they didn't get that. So it didn't go forward. But I think people were surprised by the bipartisan support that came out of the senators, especially, who are on that commission. And the model that they're using for their super committee, if you will, is very similar to what we have here in Colorado. It's called the Joint Budget Committee, mm-hmm. where we have a joint committee. We have four members, I think it's four, yeah, four members from the House and four members from the Senate who sit on the Joint Budget Committee. And you have the division of Democrats versus Republicans and House and Senate. And their job over a nine-month period is to craft a budget proposal that they bring back to the legislature at the time of the session where we actually move the long bill, the budget bill. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about it is when those members of the Joint Budget Committee hold as a voting block on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate, they usually have the power to put a majority together in both chambers. Mm-hmm. And when they do that, it allows us to pass their budget proposal through the House and the Senate. Now, of course, amendments come forward, from time to time that'll improve their work and that sort of thing. But, it has worked, at least the 8 years I've been there, it's worked every year mm-hmm. to help us, pass a balanced budget.
Do you think we can pass one nationally?
I think we can. The will has to be there. And we have to get out of this this mode where we're constantly bickering and trying to score political points. It has to be more about you and me, the middle class citizens of our country,
yep.
than it is about the representatives and senators in Washington, D.C.
So obviously there's deficit, there's debt. We've seen financial crisis over the last few years with stock markets falling apart mm-hmm. and the housing crisis and all of those things. So what do you attribute the current financial crisis to, and what would you do to prevent a crisis like the one that we are facing right now and kind of trying to get our way out of?
I think that a lot of the crisis, it's very complicated, all the different international and national factors. But, when you look at it, just fundamentally, it's a lack of planning, right? It's a lack of a vision looking across or past the horizon for what's coming up in the future. We need a long-term vision for where the economy is going and how we're going to continue to grow the economy in the future and what we're going to do to invest it to make sure that we can blossom in the future. All of those things need to be part of a long-term business plan, for lack of a better way of describing it. And if you're a business owner, if you're planning year to year, you're making a mistake. You're coming up with a plan for failure. You've got to have a business plan that extends 3, 5, 10 years out so that you know what major capital outlays you're going to make in the future, who you're going to hire, what products you're going to bring online, those types of things. I mean, it's incredible to me that the United States of America, that the state of Colorado to a certain degree, doesn't have that type of a long-range vision. Now, one thing that I did in 2010 as a Senate president was create the Long-Term Fiscal Stability Commission here in Colorado. And the goal of that Long-Term Fiscal Stability Commission was to do exactly that, come up with a long-range plan for the state of Colorado and our economic development in the future. And now Governor Hickenlooper has his TBD Colorado, which is very similar, where he's looking at kind of, organically going out to communities and saying, okay, what are your ideas? How do we put this whole thing together? That's what we're lacking at the federal level, and that's what we need to put in place.
How do we put it in place? How can constituents, how can your everyday citizen engage in that conversation?
Well, when representative democracy works, they pick up the phone and they call their representative. I mean, that's how it's set up, and that's how I've been very proud of how we've run my legislative office, where we're responsive to people when they either email or they phone. We need a Congress that is more responsive to the people of the United States of America. I can't tell you how many people I run into who say, I sent an email or I made a phone call and I got a staffer on the other end of the phone, or I got the auto response to the email and that's all I'm going to get. That sends a message to the people that, hey, look, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, and thank you very much for contacting my office. And that type of thing.
Right.
That's right. Not what we want to foster when we're talking about customer service, if you will, in government. And
right.
We need more responsive representatives in Congress.
So, Brandon, we only have a few more minutes left, but, you know, I imagine that there are some really interesting folks that have inspired you throughout your career. I mean, you seem to have a very cutting-edge approach to the leadership in politics, as and you're able to discern between politics and policy, and I think that's sort of lost. So who inspires you? Who do you admire?
You know,
dead or alive?
This is going to sound so corny. I'm so sorry. But my mom, you know, she's about 5'2".
Mm-hmm.
She was a high school, you know, Spanish teacher for 20 plus years here in Lakewood High School. You know, she has had some hard times, but she always puts her head down and just keeps moving forward. And she has a heart of gold, you know, always trying to do the right thing. Always trying to help, always there, the type of person who always shows up, you know, tries to get there on time because, you know, it's rude to be late, those types of things. I mean, those are the values that she instilled in me. And, you know, that's how I work. I mean, I just keep on working as hard as I can. And ultimately, you know, we are successful. Ultimately, we do you know, have successes for education system. This last 2 years, as we're balancing the budget, for example, there were proposals for massive cuts to our K-12 system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through my leadership, we were able to reinstate over $200 million of those cuts that were proposed. You know, those successes, you don't see them on the front page of the Denver Post all the time. But, you know, I know that we're making a difference, and it's my mom's mentorship, you know, it's her nurturing that has really helped me, you know, develop that type of a leadership style.
That's amazing, and it's great when your parents really are that inspiration that drives you. And it made me think of something, you know, as a school teacher and as somebody who has worked with kiddos all over the state, you know, we've heard a lot also about entitlements in this conversation. Tell me what that means, because I think people hear the word entitlement, the underscore of the word entitlement carries a relatively negative connotation. Talk about what that means as you head into Washington.
You know, it's tough. I earlier this week I had a meeting. I went to a breakfast that was hosted by the Longmont Chamber of Commerce. And we were at the homeless shelter in Longmont.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a tour of the shelter. It's been there for, you know, over 100 years. Got a tour of the facility itself. And I asked, I said, so, you know, the people here, they are on assistance, food stamps, that sort of thing. Yes, however, in order to live here, in order to stay here, they have to have a job. Okay, well, what are the referral services? And the woman who's touring me around, you know, gave me a whole list of the different agencies in the city who would refer the people to the shelter, and also help them, you know, find a job and be active in the community. I say, well, what happens to people when they just, you know, decide, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to, you know, hang out here. They say, well, we evict them. They just can't do that.
Right.
You know, we have a work requirement in order to get the assistance that we provide through the shelter. Well, how long can people stay here? Well, upwards of 2 years if they're complying with all of the different requirements. And if you think of entitlements in terms of the rhetoric that comes out of Washington, D.C., right,
mm-hmm.
you would think that you know, community, that homeless shelter wouldn't exist, right? Everybody would think, oh, okay, it's a bunch of people who are just hanging out and they don't have employment.
Right.
But the fact is, a lot of the agencies, a lot of the intervening services that are out there are doing the right thing, helping people get back on their feet. It's not just a handout, it's a helping hand that they're providing to get people reengaged in our communities. So certainly, we need to have that process whereby we look back and see whether or not the investments we're making are actually working and accomplishing the task that we designed for them in the first place. But we also have to recognize there are a lot of really good people out there doing very good work.
Absolutely. So, Brandon, tell us something about yourself that we don't know. What should listeners know about you?
I met my wife when I was in the Navy. I was on a destroyer stationed in Yokosuka, Japan. We made two deployments to the Persian Gulf. My wife is from outside of the Pennsylvania area, and she was teaching as a third grade teacher at the Department of Defense School on base. And we got set up on a blind date. We got married while we were in Japan, and we've been dating ever since.
And you have two beautiful kids, yes.
We do.
Fantastic. Brandon, where can listeners learn more about the Colorado plan that you're working on and all of the positions you have on things as you work
sure.
on your run?
Yeah, the website is schaefer4colorado.com. It's the best way to get information about me.
And that's Schaefer, S-H-A-F-F-E-R, 4, F-O-R, Colorado.com. Brandon, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I really can appreciate your approach to civility and politics.
Well, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. And thank you for joining us for Driving Force Radio this weekend, and have a wonderful day.
ICOSA invites you to do something different. Be a driving force. Influence change. Be a leader. Visit us at theicosamagazine.com.